Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to wherever you are joining us today. Thank you for taking time to listen and participate in this latest podcast episode. This podcast, which is the State of Digital Clinical Trials, is being brought to you by Viva. And today I am delighted to be joined by someone I've been trying to entice to appear on the podcast for a little bit of time. And I'm delighted that today she is joining me. So Emma, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm delighted that you're able to join us here in Boston, here at the Viva Summit. So it's very fortuitous to have this chance to sit down. Before we go any further, there may be some people who know you less well than I do, and you've just told me that your job title has changed. So perhaps I could invite you to not butcher it, as I no doubt will. But perhaps I could invite you just to say a few words about who you are, where you come from, and what your role is within Bayer.
Yeah, of course. So I'm Emma Earle. I'm based out of the UK, and I'm working for Bayer, and my new job title, though not a new role necessarily, is Head of Clinical Trial Management Services and Solutions. So within my team, we look at the clinical trial technologies, and within that as well, we obviously have got a large focus on our Vault Clinical implementations and the projects that go with that as well.
Perfect. Can you perhaps just give us a little introduction to your journey in industry, how you started from a degree in pharmacology, how did you come into clinical trials, and then we'll start to talk a little about how that shapes what you do today as well.
Absolutely. So actually, I when I was in school, I was pretty adamant I wanted to do medicine, I wanted to be a doctor. And my father is a doctor and sat me down and said, are you sure you really want to do this? You absolutely sure you want to do it? And it made me question it. It made me think, is this what I want to do? And what is it about medicine that I'm interested in? And actually, it was more the drug side of it. I was interested in the interactions. So from that point, I actually then went forward with a degree in pharmacology. So I had taken a year out before I went to university. And during that year, actually went and worked for a small biotech company. And I have to say, they were fabulous to me. They really helped to give me the opportunities of looking into what being a CRA was all about. And they really helped me. They said, oh, actually, we've never been on a closeout visit. We've got somebody going on a closeout visit. Why don't you go with them? Right. And I can really thank them for that introduction, which actually meant that I kind of knew by the time I came out of university, I knew what I wanted to do. So I left by the time I finished my degree. And then that was then straight into the industry at that point. So starting as a CRA in a number of different companies, CROs, had a little foray into data management as part of that.
All the best people do.
Of course. And then actually ended up at Bayer. So I actually originally started at Bayer in 1999, so 1 or 2 years ago now. Left for a period of time to have a few children and then came back again. So by that point, I'd come back into a CRA role, but started to look more into a kind of technology area. I'd had an opportunity to actually give some feedback on our EDC system and kind of enjoyed that, and then found myself veering more towards that of an area of interest. Yep. And then again, another opportunity came up to focus on that.
Do you see that transition then from the operational background into defining systems and processes, A, as natural, and B, is that where you think your passion is going forward?
For me, it was natural, yes. It was an opportunity. It was a way of really being able to see how can we make things more efficient. I think my process brain doesn't like inefficiencies, and technology and systems gave us a really good chance to achieve those efficiencies. So that's where I saw a vision of where we could utilize that to make everything quicker and easier for everybody in theory.
My wife, there's a couple of things we have in common, and I'll tell you about what my wife says about me, but I did a biochemistry degree, and the only thing I really understood after my first year was, God, I don't want to work in a lab. So that was an easy transition for me. But as part of my degree, I had a year at industry, and I fell into this thing called data management. Didn't even know what it was when I went for the interview. And I did it because I'd run out of other interviews to not go to.
Yeah.
And eventually I went and I got the job and I've never looked back. And it was a very natural fit for me. So I think there's a similarity in that path and that experience. And I think that shapes future decisions, but we might come on to that in a second. But another thing you said that resonates with me is my wife says that I am incompetent, intolerant. And I actually think that's a strength, but it sounds like you might have a little bit of that as well in some of the things you
quite possibly, yes. It is, I have recently noticed that when I've had to give a bit more on what doesn't seem like a great process, for a number of reasons, it's a little bit of me in the breaks to say I want to be able to work things into a better format and make things easier. And but sometimes you can't always do that. Sometimes you have to step back and go, okay, I'll let that one go.
But sometimes you can.
Sometimes you can, yes.
So if we may, let's go back 20 years. Mm-hmm. You started off, you've learned to be a bit of a CRA. That experience then was largely paper-based, I guess, if not entirely. How do you kind of take yourself and the people you work with now from that early day to what we do today? What do you see as the major difference? Very open question, but what do you see as the major differences? And we'll go on to perhaps what's left to solve as well, which is new routes as well. But could we start with how do you see the industry has shifted from your perspective?
Oh, it's a different world from what it was. Yes, it was completely paper-based. It was paper-based CRFs. It was paper-based DCFs. You know, my green pen and my post-it notes were my best friends going out monitoring. Yep. You know, when I look back and I think these are the days where we were allowed to bundle it all in our cars and take it, be that whatever it was you kept to pick up. And double data entry happening. I think we've come a really long way. And sometimes I think we have to recognize how far we've come as well, because it's a big, big, big change. I also remember sending out the first laptops to do EDC on, and everybody think this is never gonna work. But it did. But I do genuinely believe that a lot of the change is for the better. I think there's a lot of worry about change. I think everybody has their own personal limits of what they accept in terms of change. But when you try to explain to, say, a new monitor or a new CRA that starts now what things were like 20 years ago, it's dramatic, the differences. You know, many, many, many evenings sat in a hotel room stripping CRF pages, as used to in triplicates, which again seems unheard of now, to just log into a website and do what you need to do with EDC.
Well, I think there are certain things that have been cast from our memories. The no carbon required CRFs, the, as you mentioned, the green pen, the red pen, the blue pen, and which one you could use in which circumstance.
Yeah.
I think those are things that were probably embedded in our formative years. You mentioned starting in a biotech. I started at Glaxo, as was. And I think that's possibly the luckiest, most fortunate thing that happened to me, because they trained you so well.
Yep.
And it sounds like you had that similar experience. Do you think that's key to launching you into this world, that first formative education?
I think it is. It gave me such a breadth, very different to maybe a GSK experience, where it's very big and often you have very defined roles for a specific task. Because it was a small biotech, everybody did a lot of different things. So you actually got a really, really broad experience immediately going in. And I think for me, that worked really well. It gave me that exposure. I was very young. Some of this was before I actually started at university. I think it gave that exposure. But I do also remember actually one of my first jobs with a CRO, and one of my managers there first, and it stuck with me ever since, said, you never learn anything from something that goes well.
Yep.
You have to have all those problems. You have to problem solve. You have to troubleshoot. And that's how you learn. And I think that's one thing that's really stuck with me through the years.
Maybe we can just double click on something there. You've mentioned process roles, and you add technology to that list. How do you see that's evolved? And moving more and more into your current role, how you're changing things there. But I'm assuming going from paper-based, I'm assuming FedEx was your best friend at one point, green pens. Moving forward then into how you've seen EDC come on board, a modernized new CTMS, payments, other challenges we're facing. How have you seen that journey come across?
It's given visibility and it's given transparency, and it's also enabled us to look across studies. When you're working in a paper-based world and a very narrow world, you really haven't got the ability to learn across studies. It's very single study focused. And by having that technology and the visibility, that transparency, you can then start to see and look how things are working across. And I think that's really powerful, because I think that's where you learn. That's where you can start to see, okay, we're seeing this trend across things. You can start to see, how are we doing? What are metrics looking like? And it opens up another world of information and data that you can actually assess the whole performance across everything.
How different do you think the research you're trying to support today is to where it was 20 years ago, 10 years ago? And how does that manifest itself in terms of some of the challenges you're trying to address?
There's a lot of complexity, I would say. I think we're seeing protocols getting more and more complex, more and more edge cases coming through, and there's standardization, but because of that complexity, we're having to it's not always a one-size-fits-all approach. Yep. And it's really trying to manage that. And I think we're seeing that more and more frequently. It would be pretty boring if everything was always the same. So I don't necessarily see it as a negative, but it does mean that we have to be able to have systems and technology and processes that can accommodate those edge cases without having 25 different processes for one thing.
So what jump on that, just writing down people, process, technology. I think mm-hmm. that's an obvious place to go in a second, but something you just made me think of: science versus operations.
Mm.
You're in a company that's doing gene therapy, cell therapy, pretty advanced scientific research, and you just mentioned about one size doesn't fit all. How do you balance that? How are you balancing what your scientists are trying to do with the need to run an organization of several thousand people, keep clinical trials going? I won't even mention COVID yet, we'll come back to that. But how do you balance that scientific pull through with what you can do today? Is that a healthy tension? Is it not a tension at all? What's your thoughts there?
I think every time you get a new scenario, there's an element of tension. There's an element of, how are we gonna do that? How do we have to think about that? And that sort of slight out of the box thinking, we know we've got our parameters. You know, we've had a recent scenario where we've had to relook at the way we number our studies because of our collaborations. So it's never necessarily a complete negative. And actually, I think there's quite a lot of energy that we get from our teams by throwing a problem on the table and going, okay, how are we going to solve this? And how are we going to get around this? And how can we work with it? So I think initially there can be resistance to it in terms of, oh, this is different, it doesn't fit the mold. But usually the energy that everybody gets from that problem-solving exercise and coming out the other side, there's not a lot we can't figure out.
So let's come back to the inevitable then, people, process, technology. Do you think there's one that's more important? I'm going to push you on that. Is there one that's more important, or is it just, look, it's equally weighted amongst them?
Oh, that's a really tough one. We've seen that we can work without technology. We're just not very
Which pains me, by the way.
It does pain me, yes.
But I agree with you.
But we can, we did it.
Yep.
We did it without much technology. Yep. So we did do it, but we were slower. And there was room for error, more room for error than there is now. So as much as, you know, from somebody who works with technology to say, actually, we have done that in the past, but it wasn't necessarily efficient. We really cannot do it without our people, and we would really struggle with our process. It becomes the Wild West without some process. But I think there is a happy marriage to be made between the three parties there, really. And with people, I think you have to have people with a mindset to leverage process and technology. If you can have people who don't want to do either of those and want to do what they've always done without awareness of opportunities with technology or the opportunities and the advantages of process. So I think there's, you can work hand in hand.
I like your answer. I think you avoided any pitfalls, which is good. But I like your answer because I think coming the other way, surely technology is there to enable people to do what needs to be done. We are in an industry where people deal with people.
Yes. You know,
we've talked over the last 2 days here that where does clinical research really happen? It happens in sites when a person talks to another person, albeit a patient. So I think that's very much it. I think technology should make it better, should make it easier.
Absolutely.
And probably everyone expects me to say technology is the most important, but I'm going to say it's people. I think in our recent past, we've seen we as an industry have developed technologies that haven't changed the world the way we thought they would. Well, that's because people couldn't use them in a real world setting, or they were poorly timed or poorly designed or whatever it might be. But it's people who make or break it.
Or too many of them.
Yeah.
I think that's the other.
We're definitely going to come on to that one in a second as well.
Yeah.
But I completely agree. How do you see site centricity and patient centricity in particular changing some of what you do?
It should always have been important, I will say, but I think it's become more of a focus.
Yeah.
And I think we probably should have done it, had more focus as early as we could have done. And I think I found it very interesting being able to listen to sites in the last, you know, couple of days and to hear where their pain points are. I think the more that we can do that, the more that we can improve it for everybody. I think in terms of patient versus site centricity, access to patients is always a little bit more challenging than access to sites from a sponsor perspective. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't forget about them. But I think we also have to not just focus on patients because we forget about the site in the middle. And when you come back to the concept of people talking to people, actually, if we've got a very unhappy site, that is going to be projected onto a patient, which is not going to improve their experience of a clinical trial, and it's a bit of a catalyst then to discourage people from participating.
I think, again, I love your answer because I feel like as an industry we've, over time, I'll say disproportionately prioritized one set of users.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that to be heard as I'm saying we did it wrong. I'm just saying, I think we focused on sites and then we focused on patients. And actually, as soon as you focus on one, you let someone else down.
Yeah.
And I think this is where a balancing act needs to go on. And it's just a reweighting. I like to think of it as we're solving a Rubik's Cube, because the truth is you have to solve all six sides.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I do think that's incredibly important today. Now, shifting a little bit, because I want to come back to sites, but at the end of the day, you're talking to a data manager. So let me ask you this. Continuing that idea of people, process, technology, and solving problems, how do data management make your life easier? How do they make it more difficult? And maybe vice versa as well, from clinical ops through to data management. What do you see as the challenges and opportunities there?
I think there are a lot of opportunities, and I think that we can leverage the areas of expertise. I think one area where it has become maybe a little blurred is with the term monitoring.
Yep.
Historically, monitoring in many people's heads has been something that is done by a clinical operations site management organization, and it's CRAs going out to sites monitoring the data. And I think industry-wise, we've seen over the years that that's not the case anymore. Monitoring has got a much more broader term, broader concept, and I think it's taken us a while for each party to really understand what their role is in monitoring. And I think from a terminology perspective, there's still some confusion that creeps in. The immediate default is monitoring is yep. one set of people, and it's not it. There's a lot of people looking at that data. We've all got a part to play in that, and how can we best move forward? So I think it is a case of the industry movement that has probably added some complexity there in and around the two groups working together.
So let me see if you agree with this. You may or may not. You're very welcome to disagree. But I actually think first-generation EDC hindered this development quite a lot. Because when first-generation EDC came out, the first operating model conversation I heard was, well, that's the end of data management, and then there's this thing called risk-based monitoring. And I think when people read risk-based monitoring, what they actually heard was source data verification. And then everything else became lost in terms of that conversation. And I think we then vacillated back and said, but we don't need monitors now because data managers are doing more and more. And actually, the truth is, data managers like me are data managers for a reason. Monitors are monitors for a reason. We need both skill sets. And actually, very few data managers were born to be a monitor and vice versa. So I think that separation was kind of resisted, but actually, I think it works. And it works because you're letting people do what they're best at.
I think it works as long as everybody's aware of what their part to play is.
Yep.
And I think that's when you can kind of creep into some confusion where if everybody's trying to do everything, then you're not being efficient and you're doubling up on work. So as long as you've got kind of clear definitions of who's playing which role, as it were, then I think that's how we can, they do work hand in hand.
What about sites? You have long spoken and supported the need to do the right thing by sites and then ultimately through patients. You've been a very positively outspoken contributor to some of our site strategies. So perhaps you could share a little bit of thinking with our audience on that and then perhaps reflect on how you can help sites more and how they can help you more. Long list of ways you could take that question.
Yes, there absolutely are. We have to understand, and I think one of the pieces is being able to take advantage of understanding the problem points and not making an assumption that we know. So for me to start with is taking the opportunity at events with sites to really understand what their pain points are. And only with that, I think we can start to walk a mile in their shoes and see how we can work together. Ultimately, you know, I'm sure that every site would love us to pay them $1 million every million euros every week. But we're also working within some constraints and as well. So how can we be creative? How can we maybe solve some of the smaller problems that have a big impact and to work together? You know, I think but I also feel that understanding has to work on both sides. We've had some really interesting forums with sites, with sponsors, with CROs, where it's been a bit eye-opening. I don't think everybody fully appreciated anybody else's perspective on it. It was, you know, everybody was living within their own kind of bubbles. And the more we can do that, the more we can exchange, we can get to a point where I think both sides can make adjustments. I don't think it's just necessarily sites have to adjust to us, and I don't think it should be us 100% adjusting to sites because we have got constraints, we have got regulations that we need to consider as well.
Thank you for all the things you've shared so far. Let me switch a little bit back to your role and how that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to ask you to step over any confidentiality or anything that you shouldn't, but you know, if I think about the work you're doing today, are there priorities that you can talk about that are perhaps driving your energies?
Being able to streamline our system landscape is our, I would say for my team at the moment, is really our key priority. Yeah. So making sure that we are putting our energy into technology that can support us, hopefully minimize the energy that we have to put into integrations, leveraging a platform features where we can. I think that I'm hoping we'll have a knock-on consequence all around. We do take advantage of any implementation projects to revisit processes. So we do always look. I definitely don't really want to be lifting and shifting our process if we, unless we need to. So really to be able to take that chance to see, is this the right thing we're doing? Questioning, can we do this a better way? Can we leverage some functionality with technology? Can we rethink this? And to then just end up with a simpler landscape.
So let's think about your time in the industry. Let's take a little bit look forward, and then maybe a look forward as well. You've been involved in a lot of transformational programs. You've been involved in bringing a lot of systems on board. Are there certain highlights that jump out? And if you look forward, are there things that you're looking forward to fixing? Whether that's actually, should I call it a realistic goal yet, or just something you want to put energy into trying to be part of the solution?
I think going forward to to retire. Actually, I'm more interested in getting rid of some systems. So being able to turn systems off is a big achievement, and to be able to do that, I think, you know, our final legacy CTMS, for that to go, I think that will be a big win next year, hopefully. In terms of looking backwards, I would say we've had a few wins that stick out, and actually being able to get some of our functions to really rethink their process, and functions that I would never ever in a million years have thought would agree to it, and to really look to see actually they saw the vision that we could have with and taking advantage of technology, and they were brave enough and they were willing enough to say, actually we can do this differently. And that's exciting. That's when you think, actually we're making a bit of a difference here, being able to, but it does take those people to be willing to take that step with us as well.
You've reminded, we did one of the EDC sessions AbbVie presented, and I asked them, what are just some of the things you would put as wins in the last 6 months? And Lance said, we've reduced the number of roles from 120, I think it was, to 6. It was a very significant shift. And before he even finished his sentence, about 25 people broke out into a round of applause. And I just went, that'll be the AbbVie team. But it is, I think, that the energy that comes from fixing some problems and some issues, which I do think is kind of a key piece here. We talk about it, we may not always achieve it, is we're here to fix problems, not just add a new functionality.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big driver here, that it sounds like we're on the same page.
Yes.
Okay. So let me bring you to my final question. Mm-hmm. It's one I ask absolutely everyone. I have a feeling I know part of your answer, but if I could put you in a situation where I'm going to give you a magic wand, you can wave that wand, and maybe one thing that we've done that you just wish would disappear, be assigned to room 101 to never appear ever again, and maybe one thing that you can't do today that you really wish you could do. I have a feeling I know part of your answer for one of them, but let me put
it to now you. I'm intrigued as to what you might be thinking. This one I've struggled with a little bit, actually. I think this is a tough question. And trying to think of what I would like to get rid of. We've come a really, really, really long way, and I think that still sticks in the back of my head, that we mustn't always try and jump ahead too quickly, because I think sometimes that can be the undoing of us as well as not. But in terms of what I would like to get rid of, I'd like a very broad statement, but it's inefficiency. It's being able to get rid of some of those steps that we don't necessarily need, and that the things that we've always done that we don't always need to. I think there's a lot of things that get put in place because something's happened.
Yep.
Often we don't have processes just because somebody dreamt them up. Often it's something's happened and it's triggered a change in a process. But it's also trying to say, well, actually, can we stop, and can we really think, do we need this? So it's a very large bucket, without being too specific. Yep. So I think that's a bit of, but then on the plus, you know, the other side, flip side of kind of a magic wand, I think if we could solve that problem with making sites happy, and if we could solve that, I think that has a huge knock-on effect on patients. It then has actually a huge knock-on effect on us and our ability to run trials quickly as well. So if we can start to kind of consolidate the problems that sites are dealing with, and I do think technology is a big one here, so I do think the number of systems they're dealing with is really tough, and it's not always things that are just in our control as well. So I think that's a piece, but I think technology is an interesting one. I was thinking about this the other day, that we've also progressed in, you think of like music technology over the years. We've gone all the way through, everybody's got a Spotify account now, it's all digital. Yet my teenagers have gone back to listening to vinyl. So there's part of me that also hopes that we don't take a big step back and suddenly miss our paper CRFs. I'm pretty sure we won't, but I think it's interesting that sometimes people want the comfort that they know, and the touch and feel. So I think we have to recognise there's people and there's emotion around as well.
I love the fact you said that. So just to reveal what I thought you were going to
say. Okay.
I wrote down legacy CTMS as the thing to go on, which you kind of did so, by the lecture,
yeah.
So that's fine. But I love the way you just said that, because I am someone who still buys paper books.
Mm-hmm.
I will offset the damage I do to the environment by doing so happily, because I like the feel of a book. And as a bedroom DJ, I tried moving from vinyl to CDs, and I couldn't do it because it's not the same experience. There is something about taking the record out of a sleeve and playing with it and feeling the grooves. It just is.
Yeah.
And I think it's very interesting to watch that journey, because you look at the next generation and it's coming back to where we were. And it isn't necessarily because it's better quality. It's a better quality of experience.
Yeah.
And that's what excites me about that. And that's probably an amazing place to end. So look, thank you very much. I will come back to you and just offer you one final thought for our audience on anything you want to comment on. But I do just want to say, for everyone who has taken the time to listen to us, if you've enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you have, please don't forget to subscribe for this and, of course, all future episodes that will be coming along. But Emma, thank you very much. And maybe I'll give you the final word if there's anything else you'd like to say to any of our audience.
Just really thank you for the opportunity. It's been a great time to have a conversation. Thank you for the last few days. And I've enjoyed it.
Well, safe travels home.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming to Boston.
Thank you.
Thank you.